Up Linux docs and Linux doc dashboards. So we're on billion sensors now. I do believe that there was an email that I was supposed to address before, or probably a week's email. I just don't remember which one it was. I imagine I told the person in the message about that. Mention their comments in the next episode, and I believe I have forgotten. If there's anyone out there who completely lied to not address you or your email on the show, I do apologize. It wasn't something that I did potentially share part of the email organization. However, not entirely good at sort of keeping track of emails as they relate to shows, because I don't really have a developing project folder for each website, which now that I'm saying out loud is probably where I should manage things. I should track track per episode. Resources in that folder, and I can archive those folders, and that's how it sort of happened. But I have to be honest, I consider shows a lot more ephemeral than anything else. To me, a show comes out, and then it's over, and then I never think about it again, never, like I most of never comes back to my mind. And I know that to real life people, such as yourself, your mother, that's not how it happens. It comes out and then you listen to it like whenever you want to. But for me, once I've recorded and posted, it's done on the next one. So, and I think that's one of the things that I truly, truly enjoy about podcasting is that I can do that. Because a lot of other projects that I'm involved in are a little bit longer term and they don't get finished very quickly. It's something that hangs around and that I do archive quite well. But for the shows, I treat them a lot less sort of long term, which does actually remind me that there is a listener out there who has offered to restore for me some episodes that I've lost track of through by one way or another. And he happens to have an archive of it and has offered to send me copies of the missing episodes. I gotta say, when I first got the email, I was sure that it was some kind of it was Bill. That's who the listener is, Bill. I was sure it was some kind of scam. I thought, I don't know what this person is talking about missing shows. It's probably someone who's gonna try to like sell me back some missing episodes or something weird like that. Turns out, no, he's just a normal, everyday, actual person, and he's just being really nice. And he has some of the missing episodes, like I think from season, I don't know, 8 or 9 or something. So whenever he gets around to it, he is going to, I don't know, send me a link or something, and I'll have some more shows in the archive, if anyone listens to the archives. I mean, I know people do, but if you, dear listener, listening to it right now, if you're thinking, oh, there are some missing shows in the archive, well, fear not, Bill has got your back and is going to make those shows reappear whenever he and I sort of coordinate well enough to get the information transferred. So don't hold your breath, because I'm sure he's a busy person, and I'm not really too concerned about missing episodes, because as I've already explained, episodes are, I treat them as being ephemeral, for better or for worse. I'm not saying that's how I should treat them, it's just how I do treat them. Another thing I got from was Deep Geek. This was weeks ago now, and Deep Geek told me that he was interested in my talk about alternate text editors, which I'm going to admit to you, I don't recall. I was talking about Jed and Joe and stuff. Yeah, okay. And he said that he found one called E3, that is the letter E and then the number 3, E3. Depending on the command you invoke it with, it can start up with Pico, Emacs, Vim, WordStar, or inedit key bindings. No libraries, written in assembly. Okay, so that was Deep Geek's tip about the E3 text editor, and frankly, I was intrigued, so I went and downloaded it. The website is, where is it? sites.google.com/site/E3editor. Who knew there was such a thing as sites.google.com anymore? I didn't know it. It's in German, it looks to me like, but it's relatively simple to find the download. It's right there on the front page. It's a little folder release or tarball release, and it's the version that I downloaded was e3-2.7.1.tarball.gz, and it was all of 185 kilobytes. I downloaded it, untarred it, changed directory into the resulting folder, and typed in make. It compiles it and provides one binary with a couple of links. So the binary is E3, and then it symlinks to these commands that DPeak was referencing. There's E3EM, which allows you to start it with Emacs key bindings, E3VI for Vim, E3Pi for Pico, E3NE, you know, and so on. I guess that would be in edit, and then E3WS, which I guess is WordStar. And it's little, tiny little binary. I mean, it is 13 kilobytes, E3 is. I've never seen anything quite that small. I don't think that I could actually run, and it runs just fine. So obviously I launched it with the E3EM for my Emacs mode, and it's a micro editor, E3, enter file name or leave with return. So I'll do a test dot adoc, and now I'm in the Emacs mode, and I can type, let me type a title, goes here. And then I would put maybe author, Klaatu, email, and so on. Going back to the beginning of the line, Control A, Control K to cut the line, Alt X to set mode. Well, there is no ASCII doc mode. I can't really find any tab completion here, so I don't really know what any of that's doing. But there doesn't seem to be a question mark for help in that mode, so I'm not sure. Control X H does bring me to a little help menu, and that really just shows me that the keys are X, you know, Control X, Control C to exit, Control X, Control S to save, X, F to load a file, and so on. So it kind of gives me sort of the basic Emacs shortcuts that I would normally expect anyway. So what I'm trying to express is that it doesn't feel like Emacs, or it doesn't look like Emacs. This isn't going to trick anyone into thinking, oh, that's Emacs. This is just, it's using Emacs key bindings to perform text editing function. And honestly, for 13 kilobytes, that's all I need. I think I said in the previous episode about text editors that the surface user experience for a text editor is about 80% of the problem. That's that daily interaction, that's really what you care about half the time. And certainly for quick edits to configuration files, that's all you care about, probably. So yeah, it's pretty nice, actually. It's pretty neat. I'm impressed. I had fun testing it out. Am I gonna switch to it? Well, not for real life. Is it something I'm gonna keep handy on every server that I ever touch? Yeah, I think it's a great thing to have. What a great little trick, tip and trick. Thank you, DeepGeek. Fascinating. E3, 13 kilobytes. All of your text editing needs within reason. And now on to LM sensors. So let's do a var log packages LM sensors. This is the next in line for the Slackware packages. As I try to say at the beginning of all the episodes lately, if you're not running Slackware, that's fine. You can still follow along with this because you probably have access to most of these things, or you can learn from them anyway. You just learn about what's available on Linux. So LM sensors provides two binaries. One is called sensors and one is called sensors-conf-convert. Probably guess what that does. Maybe you can't, I don't know. So sensors, the command, prints sensor information from your computer. So I'm just going to type in sensors and hit return, and it tells me that there's a K10 temp-PCI-00C3. Don't know what that's talking about. Probably my graphics card, maybe. And it says the adapter is a PCI adapter. The temperature currently is 23.4 Celsius. That's roughly, let's call it 70 some odd degrees. Actually, maybe less. It might be 60 degrees. And it tells me that the high is 70 degrees Celsius, and the critical is 90 degrees Celsius, so I'm well under. That's good to know, I reckon. And then it tells me that I've got an FAM15H power PCI 00C4. adapter, PCI adapter. And you can, so right now it's kind of formatted, kind of nice and pretty, and has human, sort of human readable or human familiar words. If you do a dash U, which I think is the long version, no, it's just dash U, you can see the raw output, which I don't think that's super useful for just reading the output yourself. I mean, it does kind of give you an indication of what some of these things mean. So temp1 underscore input 25, temp1 max 70, temp1 crit 90, and so on. So you kind of get obviously the raw output of probably the property assigned to that device by the manufacturer giving, you know, outputting the sensor data. But it might be better for parsing as well, I would imagine, because the non-raw output kind of has output all over the place, whereas the raw output just gives you pretty much in a straight column, single column, just the data. So if you're parsing that, then that might be the better way for viewing or for parsing specifically. You can also force everything to go to Fahrenheit. That'd be dash dash Fahrenheit sensors space dash dash Fahrenheit, or just dash F, and that shows you, oh yeah, okay, so it's the 23 Celsius is 74 Fahrenheit. That's useful, actually. It's a useful conversion. I think now in Celsius, because that's the temperature is given to people in New Zealand in Celsius. But I grew up with Fahrenheit, so I know both, but I don't have it in my head. The immediate equation, the converting between the two. Well, not converting. I know how to convert, but just that sort of instantaneous when you hear 23. Do you think 74? No, you think 23. But this is nice to actually get it converted for me, because I just don't have that instant conversion. Now, there's also a dash dash set option, which you tell sensors the command to evaluate all set statements in the configuration file. And this kind of pushes us toward the root only set of toys that come along with Alum sensors. So there's this dash dash set one for the configuration file, but then there's some further binaries in SBIN, in user SBIN. So generally you wouldn't have access to that as a normal user. You might with sudo, but it is meant for privileged users to be able to do. And the commands are fan control, ISA dump, ISA set, PWM config, and sensors dash detect. Set statements in the configuration file, I don't know that they use exactly those commands, but there is all kind of toward the same goal, which is rather than reading sensor data, it is setting sensor data. Now, not everything can be set that way. It really depends on the device that you're looking at, or the component that you're looking at. Depends on what kind of inputs and outputs it accepts. So you can't, for instance, look at the heat of some device and then just set it to overheat. That's not necessarily something that you can do. On the other hand, you could, for instance, override a fan control such that under certain conditions it goes full power. That's a default that you'll find sometimes on computers, is that if the computer is on and everything's aware and it is no longer receiving sensor data about what the fan speed is, then it defaults to maximum fan speed, because it figures it's better to just turn the fans entirely on than to overheat and melt the CPU. So that's something that you will actually find in a lot of the firmware of different computers. And that's kind of what fan control enables you to do, in fact. Now, I don't have fan control on my system. That's not something that my system is hooked up with. But there is the fan control command, and it is a shell script for use with LM sensors. It reads configuration from a file, calculates fan speeds from temperatures, and sets the corresponding PWM outputs to the computed value. This is pretty dangerous stuff, because you're starting to treat your motherboard as an Arduino. you're just starting to talk directly to electrical components, and I'm not comfortable doing that on my main machine. Not going to try this command right now, I apologize, but literally, if you use this and you start talking straight to, directly to your motherboard and redirecting power, you are potentially doing bad different things. You could overheat a CPU, you could overheat the fan, you could break your fan, and so on. There is the PWM config command, though. I think I've mentioned that, right? Yep, there is PWM config, and this one is a sort of a wrapper around all of this stuff, and it tries to figure out where the fans are and what a normal speed for those might be, and so on. And so the goal is to come up with a reasonable config for what your fans should be doing or should do in cases of increased activity and so on. And again, I'm not going to play around with this on my main system because it's not really something that I have a problem with, and I'd like to not have a problem with it. That's something that I would enjoy. Just continuing, sort of having blissful unawareness about. That's not to say I've never done this. This is definitely something that I have had to mess around with at an old job of mine. There was a server line that I was working on, and we would get new images, nightly builds of the OS for the server, and you know, at some stages of that process, it was pretty raw, and so sometimes. Or a very frequent feature was updated firmware for the server. And so when we would flash the new firmware onto the server, the fans would always go on 100%, because like I say, when the sensors stop sending data, the default is to go full speed. Don't turn it off, go full speed, because if something's amiss, the best thing for that server is to have air circulating through it, not for the fans to go off. So it was always a very loud process, the updating of firmware. That was a very loud time in the morning around the office or the lab, such as it was. So that's PWM config and fan control. There's also an ISA dump command, which examines ISA registers. Now, I don't know a whole lot about this. ISA, I know, is the instruction set architecture. That's what that stands for. This is the sort of the capabilities and functions of a CPU. Registers are, as you might expect, registry, a register. It's little bits of memory, essentially. I don't know exactly the architecture of where that memory sits. I'm not clear on that. But little bits of energy, of memory associated with your CPU, and ISA dump looks into those and dumps that information for you. This can be a dangerous process because you're not really meant to go poking around here. I mean, not manually, not without information. And in fact, if you try to run this command, it does warn you before continuing. It tells you straight up, running this program can cause system crashes, data loss, and worse. And then it sort of reiterates what it's about to do. So according to the ISA dump command page, the default starting point for this is, I thought I saw the default starting point. Well, you would think it would be 0x0000. So let's try that. ISA dump dash F 0x0000. And sure enough, it warns me, hey, you're about to go through the address range of 0x0 to 0xFF. Could cause a crash or worse. Do you want to do this? And then you can say yes or no. I'm going to say no, because once more, I really don't want this thing to crash. Don't want to mess up my computer. Not up for that. So a couple of different options for this. There's dash F to enable flat address space mode. That's what we were just running. Dash Y to disable interactive mode. So that's automatically assume yes. So you would not want to use that unless you know what you were doing. Dash K followed by a list of bytes to send as key sequence to enter the chip configuration mode. Definitely not going to go near that. Don't know how to do it. Don't want to configure anything. I'm happy to ignore that one. Dash capital W to perform a 16-bit read. Dash capital L to perform 32-bit read. And that's it. Those are the options. Pretty simple little application, I guess. And it's just something that I'm not going to mess around with, but that I can imagine someone who understands this stuff would be completely excited about, because that looks like a really powerful introspection tool. It gets more dangerous, though. If you want to do more, you can do ISA set, which is obviously different than ISA dump, and it is sort of it's going the other way. This is going to set register modes, or registers, rather, ISA registers. You can do it dash F to do your flat address space, dash Y to avoid the yes or no answer question, and then the dash W or dash L for 16 or 32 bit. And again, I'm not going to try that. Not even going to go near that one. Not even going to type in the command, because I would most certainly do something very, very wrong. What's less dangerous is sensors dash detect. And this again is being executed as root, and it says it's going to help determine kernel modules you need to load to use LM sensors most effectively. It's generally safe and recommended to accept the default answers unless you know what you're doing. And then it goes through what you can do, and it's very friendly. It tells you what's safe, what's not safe, and so on. So for instance, some Southbridge's CPUs or memory controllers contain embedded sensors. Do you want to scan for them? This is totally safe. So I'll type in yes, and it does the scan pretty quickly. And it tells me that I've got some AMD family 15H thermal sensors, and that's the K10 temp. I've also got an AMD power sensors. Oh, okay, so that power unit was for the CPU. That makes more sense. And so on. Yeah, nothing else. That's all I have. So, for instance, I do not have Intel digital thermal sensor. That doesn't surprise me. I do not have a VIA or VIA. Nano thermal sensor. Again, not surprised by that, wouldn't have expected it. Then it goes into a little bit more exciting territory. It says some super IO chips, which I don't even know what that is, but boy, does it sound neat. I mean, it says super right there in the name, contain embedded sensors. We have to write to standard IO ports to probe them. This is usually safe. Like, I'm going to type no to that. And it goes on from there. There are words like usually, normally, probably, and so on. And so I'm going to cancel out of that process. But that would be something to do. If you're on a new system and you want to check things out, you might try that. Might not. If you don't have any reason to, maybe don't. But it is interesting. And it's so cool that you can just kind of talk to your hardware so directly with a tool that just happens to come with your OS. You're not going to see that elsewhere, which is fine, because I'm also advising you in the same breath that I'm using to praise the ability to have such a thing. I'm also advising you to kind of ignore it just in case. Okay, so let's look at the last one here. That's sensors-conf-convert, and that is a sensors configuration conversion application. So you can run a configuration file through this command and convert it to the latest version of the configuration file. Not very exciting, something that you probably don't have to do. Maybe it's exciting for a distribution maintainer out there who had to change, you know, update their configuration files, or maybe to a hardware hacker who's really messing around with low-level stuff like this. But for you and me, not that big of a deal. But the syntax is sensors-conf-convert, and then what's that, less than symbol, so redirecting it to the left, /etc/sensors.conf, and then redirect output to /etc/sensors3.conf, for instance, which would convert the old style version 2 configuration file to the new version 3 format. That's it. That's LM sensors, and I think that's probably time for coffee, unless I'm mistaken. Nope, checking my watch here. Time for coffee. Coffee. I'm still drinking my Amsterdam coffee. This is coffee from Ken Fallon. Really, really tasty coffee called Simon something, Simon L something. And it's mild. It's a mild, gentle coffee. It's really, really good. I think, I mean, I know I've said I like mild coffees. It's just kind of a pleasant, sort of a very pleasant tasting. I like that. The harsher coffees that kind of have that sort of burn or almost, I don't know, a harsh sort of flavor to it, flavor profile. I'll have it, you know, now and again. But I like those kind of smooth ones because you can just drink that all day. You just drink it all day long and it just tastes so, so good. Next up is LSOF. This is a great one. This is helped me quite a lot through the years of using Linux. And as far as I know, I guess I'll find out in a minute, as far as I know, it stands for List Open Files. Yep, List Open Files. That's exactly what it stands for. It does exactly what it suggests. It does. It literally lists open files on the system that you're on, which is really actually quite handy for any number of reasons. But the time that I first encountered this was early on. I was trying to unmount a disk, eject a disk from my system, and it wouldn't eject, or it wouldn't let me, it wouldn't tell me it was okay to remove the drive. Couldn't figure out why. And someone or something pointed me at LSOF, and I did a list of open files, saw that I had a file on that volume open currently, and realized that it wouldn't let me remove the drive because there was an open file from that drive, and it just wasn't going to let me do that to myself, which was appreciated. And I then sort of started using LSOF when I needed it. So it is a good sort of forensic type or investigative type of application for when your system maybe isn't behaving the way that you think it should. For instance, you're trying to unmount a volume and it just won't let you do it. So that is useful. It's also something that could be useful as kind of an investigative tool if there's something, if you're running something and you're not sure what it's using, then LSOF can help you figure that out. LSOF is not as kind of humble of a command as it is. Like, you don't really hear or think about LSOF all that often, probably, and yet it is a very, very robust application. Lots of options. Unfortunately, all of the options are defined in shorthand, in short options. There's no long options, so you just have to remember random letters, pretty much. That's what you get to remember. Think of a random letter, put a minus or a plus in front of it, and see what happens. That's my critique of LSOF, is that it doesn't do you any favors for learning the command. The documentation is pretty complete, but it is difficult, at least for me, to read through, because so much of it is just, I mean, like, look, here's the opening, here's the syntax definition, synopsis, LSOF, square bracket, dash question mark, ABCHKLNNOPRTUVVX, close square bracket, dash AA, dash CC, plus CC, plus type, minus DD, plus type, minus DD, and so on. It just goes on and on like that. Just letter, 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 letter. It's a pity. But anyway, so the default behavior of LSOF is success, which I love. LSOF, press return, and it lists all open files belonging to all active processes. Now, that, as you can imagine, is a pretty long list, and it gives you a lot of output. It doesn't filter down what it's giving. It gives you everything, which can probably be useful, and certainly you can grep through that big list, the big dump of all these open files, but LSOF itself has options to help you avoid having to just do pure greps. Not that anything's wrong with a grep, really. I do that all the time as well, but I would think that some of the really common uses of this would be, for instance, well, let's open E3. Let's open specifically a file in my downloads directory. I've got anything. Here's an HTML file. Yeah. So that's open in E3 just for demonstrations, and that's in my downloads folder. So now if I suspect for any reason that a file is open, is being used, that is located in my downloads folder, I could do LSOF plus D, as in directory, actually specifically recursive directory, and then /downloads. Give it a moment to find everything and filter everything out, and sure enough, I've got bash, man, shell, all things that are happening in the downloads folder, and then finally E3EM. PID 2371. File description is a TXT, and this column is useful, actually, file description, because, so it says bash, PID 1996, user CLAT2, file description, CWD, meaning that's your current working directory. That's why that directory is quote-unquote open, like occupied, and then it goes on and tells you that that is indeed home class U downloads E3-271. And then E3, it explains which file is occupied in the E3 directory. So that's pretty much what I wanted. I could also just do, instance, let's say that I know the command that I want to list open files of, the command that is using files. So that's the plus C option, I believe. Maybe it's in minus C. I'm not seeing the plus C. This man page is really difficult to parse. Yeah, it's minus C. So LSOF minus C, and then what did I say? E3. And that shows me all PIDs 2371, all of the things that E3 is currently occupying. And it shows that it has something open from couple of different directories, actually, because it does. So yeah, that's pretty useful. That's good. Let's see, what else do we have to do? Well, of course, there's just LSOF and then the path to the location, or to the mount point that you want to introspect. So if I did /run/media/cloud2/mydrive, it'll show me all the files that are open from mydrive. And in this case, there's this E3 one that I had opened earlier. Not the one that I opened earlier. There is an E3 process that is open on mydrive. And then there's a bash process open on mydrive, which I think is the terminal that I have the man page open in. Yeah, I think so. So yeah, all kinds of information here. And useful stuff, because you don't always remember, especially if you're one of those sort of chronic tmux or GNU screen or even just backgrounding jobs. If you do that, then quite often you lose track of either what's open or where you left yourself last, which I do pretty severely. I do that pretty badly. I think the benefit of knowing Linux well enough, I mean, knowing a terminal well enough, is that you don't have to leave a place to do something. So, for instance, right now, I don't even know what, and I keep my prompt very minimal. I do not, I know that some people have, like, the current directory sort of populate their prompt. I never do that. I can't stand it. I want minimal prompt. I don't know why. I just, from used to, that's what I prefer. So I keep it minimal, which, again, like, this is all fine until I wander off into some directory on some drive somewhere and then just get busy working somewhere else. Now, I feel like when you're a new user, at least when I was a new user new to the terminal, I remember, you know, if I wanted to cat a file or grep through a file, I would go to the place where the file was. You know, I would cd /home/cloud2/documents/ whatever, and then I would cat the thing, and then I would pwd to make sure where I was, where I thought I was, and then I would do an ls to see what was in the directory. And finally, I would go back to some other place. You know, I was always going places. I would never do anything from another location. I feel like once you get better at terminal stuff, you want to cat something on a different drive or a different location, you just cat /whatever. And then you've done it. You've catted it to your terminal, and then you continue going from where you already are. So I do feel like I do tend to get lost a lot, because I'll just wander off into a place, and then I'll just sit there and open up an Emacs session and just forget that I've just opened up an Emacs session that I'm not going to close for the next 3 days on a drive that I might want to take with me later. But LSOF helps me locate or identify the times that I do that, which is really, really useful. Okay, let's see. So that's plus capital D, as I told you, is recursively searching through a directory for an open file to list an open file. Minus capital D, is that a thing? I don't even know if that's a thing, actually. I think it's either minus capital D, yep, it is, directs LSOF's use of the device cache file. The use of this option is sometimes restricted. See the device cache file sections that allow it. Minus D must be followed by a function letter. A letter can be B for build, I for ignore, R for read, and U for read and update. Okay, I've never actually used that. Let's try it real quick, just for kicks. I have no idea what to expect. We'll do it real quick, minus capital D on downloads, and I didn't put a letter after it. Sure, let's do a U. It's still not working. Yeah, I don't know what minus capital D does exactly, but what I was gonna actually say is the capital D means recursive. If you don't want it to recurse through a directory, you can do either plus D or minus, or I should say, plus lowercase d, and that looks through the directory, but does not recurse into subdirectories when it's looking for open file. It's a little bit weird and deceptive because this, so it finds the process that is located in downloads, even though apparently the location is a subdirectory. So it, for instance, bash, it tells me is occupying this space, but the place where bash is in a subdirectory of downloads. Not sure why that's there, to be honest. I feel like that shouldn't be there, but it could be. It's probably, I'm assuming, some kind of subtlety of definition of what a file is. So those are the D options. Now the minus I option, the dash I, I should say, is the interface, or I'm assuming it means interface. It's the network one anyway. So if you want to look at active network connections, you can do that with LSOF. You probably thought you had to do it with like netstat or something like that. No, you can do it with LSOF. Here's what the man page has to say about it. So it selects listings of files, any of whose internet address matches the address specified in I. This man page, it is a challenge. Okay, so what that's theoretically saying is that I should be able to do an LSOF dash I and then provide the internet address of the connection I've made, and it gives me an error. It says that the address 192.168.11 in dash I, the address is an unknown protocol name. That's a little bit odd because the man page specifically said that the value of I would be the address, and this is telling me that it wants a protocol name. Now the man page does talk about the protocol name. It says you can issue or you can use the IP version, so either 4 or 6. So mine's 4 because I don't have, my provider actually doesn't do IPv6 yet still. Dash I, I mean, I'm on VDSL. Internet in this area is not the greatest. Dash I 4, and then, I don't know, let's do the address again. No, doesn't understand. It says no such file or directory for that address. All right, well, let's try the protocol type as well. So we'll just do UDP because I happen to know that will be a short list. So dash I 4 and then UDP. That doesn't work either. It says status error on UDP, no such file. All right, well, we'll cram 4 and UDP together. No spaces between the two. So that's LSOF space dash I space 4 UDP, all one string. And that works. That gives me all the IP four connections of type UDP on all addresses. So now if I try to narrow the address range, well, actually that won't work because I don't have enough to play with there. I guess we'll try TCP. That gives me a better list of stuff to play with. So if you keep reading in the man page, it eventually gets around to telling you that host addresses must be preceded by the at symbol, no matter what. Even if there's no user, it has to have the at symbol. And ports, a port number has to be preceded by a colon. Doesn't matter what port it is, doesn't matter. Gotta have the colon in front of it. So those are required parts of the host name and port number, which are optional, but if you're going to use them, that's how you notate them. Now that's several paragraphs after you've been told that these things are items that you can specify. In other words, I am urging you, if you delve into LSOF man page, read the whole description by each option. The options are short, but their descriptions are long and arguably not ordered in the optimal way. That is to say, I would have accompanied the requirement of the at symbol or the colon when I was telling the user that they could enter a host name or a port number or a host address for that matter. So in order to filter this down, LSOF-I, we could say for TCP at the address, and that works. Or we could even just put dash I space at the address, and that narrows it down as well because it matches that address. Or part of the address is matched anyway, because actually the name column for this entry contains both my originating address and then a little arrow to the destination. So you get both parts of that connection. This is a really useful output though. This is really nice. It shows you the command, it shows you the PID, it shows you the user, it shows you the protocol, it shows you the exact address. Really, really useful. It's really easy output to read. Definitely check that out if you're ever unclear about what kind of connections are happening from your machine. That's it. This is a great way to find that information out. Really, really useful. I mean, do you remember the days back when you would want sort of a phone home alert? You can get that with LSOF-I, and then whatever you want to filter it by. In this case, you probably wouldn't want all that much if you didn't know what you were looking for. Maybe you would want the name, the command that was doing it. I'm not sure. Either way, there's another flag that I'm going to mention here, and that's -R, and this one's really easy to use. It puts it on repeat, -R for repeat. So if you just want to open up LSOF and kind of monitor things, then -R it'll just leave it open, and you can monitor connections as they occur. It's really useful. It's almost like top for LSOF. The way to read it though is kind of in reverse of top, which makes sense if you think about it. It's kind of a list and you're tailing the list. So for instance, if I close out of my SSH session with my server, nothing happens. If I reopen it, however, then going back to that tab, there it is. It says this SSH connection 32.418 is the PID, IPv4 protocol TCP from this to that, and then established. So, and that just appears at the bottom of the list because that's the most recent thing. Really, really useful. Just a great command, honestly. It can be very confusing. The documentation, the man page. It's one of those things that it contains a lot of information, and then the information that it does contain is delivered at a rather leisurely pace. So you get there in the end, but it does take it a little while to get there. So just be patient, read the whole thing, kind of understand the concept of the option before attempting. That's it. That's LSOF. A really, really useful command. You should check it out. You should use it. And next time we're going to start out with LSSCSI, or List SCSI, as I guess it would technically be called. You know what? Maybe we could just knock that out right now. Let's find out how much is in this package. One command. We can do this. Okay, so LSSCSI, I've heard different people say it different ways, but I've always said it's SCSI. It lists SCSI devices or hosts and their attributes. SCSI, in case you don't know, was a rather popular high-speed connection. It was a cable. That kind of looked, to look at it, you might mistake it maybe for like a parallel cable. If you don't know what that is, if you looked at it, you might have mistook it for a DVI cable. If you don't know what that is, you might, I don't know what to tell you if you don't know what that is, actually. That's a tough one. It's like a big VGA cable. If you don't know what that is, it's kind of like a serial cable. I don't know. They're cables with pins. It's old stuff. Old cable stuff. So SCSI was really, really old, and at the time it was fast. That was the fast option. And that's SCSI, and from what I've heard, people generally call it SCSI. And it is, in fact, the reason that on Linux the drives, the hard drives, are SBA, because the S stood for SCSI, believe it or not. HDA, I don't remember what that stands for, HD. But I mean, I've never really seen HDA. I've seen it in documentation, old documentation, but modern drives are always, they seem to pretty much be called SD somethings. SDA, SDB, SDC, SDD, and so on. Now, not all of them. For instance, on my fancy new work laptop, and by new, I don't mean actually new, but newer than other devices that I own. On that one, there's what was it called? The flash drive or whatever, solid state drive, and it gets the designation NVMe0, and then N1, and then N1 P1 for a partition, and so on. So you see variation on different models and different technologies, but it's pretty common at the time of this writing to see SD something, and that is actually referring to SCSI, because I guess when SCSI was still around and USB came onto the scene, I guess they just figured they would just kind of keep going with the SCSI designation, even though it was USB. I don't know why they didn't change it to UDA or UDB or UDC and so on, but they just, for whatever reason, it got that S designation. So anyway, LS SCSI does probably what you would imagine it would do, which is list SCSI devices. And as you can imagine, if all of your drives are designated with that SD prefix, then when you type in LS SCSI, it lists all of those devices. That's pretty much what it does. It's pretty simple. So in that sense, I guess it's a little bit like a LS block, LSBLK, which we covered back in the AAA package series or whatever it was, maybe just A, I forget what it's called. Yeah, just A, right? So that's a pretty useful thing. You can get lots of information on these things if you do, for instance, --classic. You'll get potentially more information than you could possibly want. It'll give you all kinds of information. And there are lots of different variations on the kind of output that you get. So for instance, LS SCSI --device tags on at the end the device designator of that drive. So I get numbers like 8:0, 8:16, 8:32, 48, 64, 80, 112, and so on. I don't really know what that actually refers to because, it says that it's a probable SCSI device name, but I don't know the significance of that. So, I don't know why you would do that, but you can get that. The classic, like I said, that gives you all kinds of information. You can do --generic for the generic device name. Let's try it. It gives me nothing new at all. I mean, it gives me dashes in the last column. I don't think that's super useful. No, I don't think that's useful. I mean, I don't know how much of this is useful and how much of it is possibly not useful because they're not really SCSI devices. I don't know if that makes a difference. I'm just purely speculating. Okay, so then there is the --hosts option. Hosts, I have to type in the command correct, and that shows me the name of the subsystem that these drives are attached to, which frankly I'm pretty sure we got that out of the default. No, I imagined it. Okay, so this tells you what subsystem it's attached to. In other words, AHCI, USB-storage. In other words, how the drive is physically connected to your computer, which I think is great. And I wish that was, I think that should be a part of the default output of list block or anything really. I mean, that's just hugely important for people to understand at least some notion of where their drive is. And if it's just the difference between, yeah, this is internal, this is external. Good, great. That's that much more information to help me zero in on a drive, especially since a lot of times when you're looking for a drive manually, it's because you need to do something to that drive, like format it or erase it or copy a Linux distro onto it or something like that. So I think that's really, really fantastic, that particular option. I think is a good one. All right, let's see what else we've got. We got -k to use Linux default algorithm for naming devices. I don't think that's very useful, to me at least. You can certainly play around with it. List --list gives all kinds of information about the drive, such as what kind of drive it is, for instance, or rather how it identifies itself, I guess. For instance, Toshiba external USB 3.0 or generic mass storage. A lot of this is just a window into the information that you could get from /proc/SCSI or whatever, /dev/disks/by-id or whatever, you know, that sort of the subdirectories within proc and within dev. You can get some of this information from there, but by doing it this way, you get, in theory, more targeted information. But I mean, certainly the LS SCSI --list, no, it wasn't a list, sorry, it was, I have to find it again, --device, I think it was, let's do that, let's try that, no, it's not that one either, there's one in here, I don't remember which one it was, maybe K, no, there's one in here, there's an option in here that gives you practically the same, oh, it was classic, That's what it was. I just saw it in the help menu. Classic. It's basically doing a cat of proc SCSI slash SCSI. It gives you the exact same help. You can also find out the information like, well, again, what it's kind of connected to. So I'm not sure if it's an internal or external. Do a dash dash transport, and it'll show you whether it's hooked up to your SATA connection or through a USB connection. And dash dash unit provides the information of not the UID, because I think that's very specific to the FSTAB, but the serial number or whatever to the drive. I'm not really sure what this number is. It's like the thing that you are given when you look at a device, and it gives you the manufacturer, the product ID and the vendor ID and that stuff. Whatever that's called, that's here in the dash dash unit output. You can get some similar, I guess, related information, sort of vendor-specific information with dash W, which gives you the WWN for the disks, and that's information, again, that you get by slash dev slash disk slash by dash ID slash WWN asterisk, according to the help screen. So you can get kind of a lot of that really nitty-gritty stuff, and it's kind of priceless in a way, honestly. I mean, if your system is more than just a laptop, then this is essential. By laptop, I mean if your system has more than one drive, like if your file system is spread across multiple drives, then this is absolutely essential. And even if your file system is just, or even if your computer rather has a couple of different drives, maybe not even, you know, they're separate file systems completely, this is still useful because you just get a better idea of which drive it is that's assigned to that very cryptic SDA, SDB, SDC. I mean, that doesn't mean anything. This tells me something, at least. It can give me a notion of what model that is. This ST1000. Okay, well, I know which one that is now because I remember putting it into my computer. I remember sliding that into the drive bay. This is a USB 3.0. Okay, well, now I know which one those are. Those are the Toshiba drive. This is an ADATA USB flash drive. Okay, got it. You know, so it gives you a lot of real world insight into what really is quite cryptic. Dev SDA, Dev SDB, and so on through J. That's literally how many drives I have connected to this system, A through J. So this is really, really useful. LS SCSI. Try it out. Get familiar with the hardware on your machine. It's important, especially if you're going around mucking around with different drives, doing potentially harmful stuff. You don't want to write over the wrong drive. So use LS SCSI for clearer insight if you need it. All right, that's it. Next time, since we've just done LS SCSI, we'll do LXC. That's a really fun one. It's fun because it's containers. Containers are super important. I think I've probably talked a little bit about containers before. I know I've done a Hacker Public Radio episode about them. I think we talked a little bit about it with NS, you know, some of the namespace stuff, NS Inter and Unshare and stuff like that. LXC, that'll be next. That will be fun, I guarantee it. Okay, that's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Swagger Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time. I know my goals. I am intelligently aggressive like they sell. But my total knowledge of merchandise, using appropriate adjectives, I act with an always positive mindset. The more I sell,